I'm Jess Harold, and welcome to the latest episode of On the Case. This time we're taking a look at the recent Court of Appeal decision in Generator versus Lidl. One that could be said to raise the question, when is a joint venture not a joint venture? With me today is James Souter, partner at Charles Russell Speechleys, here to provide expert commentary on the importance of the case. Pleasure to have you here, James.
Thanks, Jess.
So, Generator v. Lidl really illustrates what can go wrong when parties explore the possibility of a joint venture, but don't quite go through with it. Can you outline what happened in this case?
Yes, well, I mean, as you've alluded to, it was it's a difficult case and a difficult set of facts. Inevitably, with these types of sort of joint venture gone wrong cases, the facts are complicated. They involve difficult negotiations between at least three different parties. You've got the two proposed joint venture partners, mm-hmm. and then you inevitably have a vendor or seller of the land. In this case, it relates to the purchase of development property in Brentwood, the Waits Way Industrial Estate. Both Generator and Lidl had come to this opportunity separately. Lidl obviously looking to develop the land into one of their supermarket sites, and Generator were a well-known mixed-use developer in the Brentwood area and had identified the fact that the land had been designated for residential use in the local plan, so they saw an opportunity. Interestingly, it was the seller who suggested that Lidl and Generator talk together about the opportunity. They saw the possibility of a mixed use development with Lidl and Generator both capitalising from the opportunity. So the discussions began towards the end of October in 2013. Generator and Lidl spoke to each other. There were a whole course of meetings, and heads of terms for a proposed joint venture were swapped in different iterations over the course of the next sort of 2 or 3 months. I think, as you've alluded to in the intro, the unfortunate fact is that they never got there. They never agreed the specific terms on which they would pursue a joint venture. I think during the course of the discussions, it had been agreed between the parties and with the seller that Lidl would purchase the property. They would be the named purchaser in the bid that was accepted. But the bid clearly had Generator as their joint venture partner at that stage. I think a particularly interesting and difficult feature of the case is that the owner of Generator was a friend of the owner of the seller.
Okay.
And in fact, and it was that sort of local knowledge, and the seller was comforted very much by Generator's involvement, which is, I think, probably why they suggested that Lidl and Generator speak together. And I think Generator's reputation in the local market, the seller thought, would be a real positive for the site. That's all the more galling for Generator when things went wrong.
So come
December time, a bid had finally been accepted by the seller. We're talking, it was just shy of £7 million. A lockout agreement for the sale and purchase was entered into between the seller, Lidl and Generator, providing a period of exclusivity until 14th of February 2014, an unfortunate date in many ways, because they fell out of love at that point. After the bid had been accepted in December, discussions for the joint venture continued, but unfortunately were never finalised. I think it's important, we'll come on to it later, that all of the discussions were subject to contract between Generator and Lidl.
Three very important words.
Well, indeed. And, you know, I think all of us have a very clear understanding in the legal profession what that means. And, you know, I think the general public have a pretty good idea as well. But we'll talk about that later. And so the 14th of February arrived, and by that time, as I say, no formal terms had been agreed, no contract was in place or formal agreement between Generator and Lidl, but Lidl went ahead and purchased the site anyway, as had been envisaged by the agreement with the seller. And for about 6 weeks after that, discussions between Generator and Lidl continued. But then they effectively petered out into nothing, and Lidl decided to go it alone. So, you know, against that background, Generator then decided that, having been, in its mind, critically important to the opportunity and enabling Lidl to proceed and pursue the purchase, With its local knowledge and some input on the planning side of things. Mm-hmm. They then felt aggrieved and decided that they wanted to take some action to right the wrong that they perceived had happened. And the way that they put forward the case was that effectively Lidl, whilst they had purchased the land as had been anticipated, they held it on a constructive trust for mm-hmm. the benefit of both Lidl and Generator. And that takes us back to the case of Pallant and Morgan, which is a classic from the early 1950s. And it established a principle that where two parties have been discussing the purchase of a property and one proceeds and excludes the other, mm-hmm. that if the circumstances are such that justify it, the court will find that the party who has effectively committed the wrong will hold the property on trust for the benefit of both.
Mm-hmm. And so that dispute between the parties went through the High Court, and it's gone through now the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal has given its decision in the case. So how did they apply that Pallant equity, and what did the court actually decide?
Well, the Pallant and Morgan equity is a real difficult beast. You will obviously be aware that for it to arise or be argued, it requires there to be a lack of legal obligation between mm-hmm. the parties. And so inevitably, the facts of the cases are difficult. The Pallant and Morgan case is, you know, it's a classic from the early 1950s. And it related to a piece of land between, effectively, it was between the properties owned by A and B, mm-hmm. and it was for sale by auction, and the owners of A and B each instructed an agent to attend the auction and bid on the property. The agents realised that they were both likely to be bidding in competition and decided between themselves that that would only mean that one of them paid more. The agent for property B agreed that he would stay out of the bidding, so in circumstances where the agent for property A succeeded, he would share the spoils with the owner of property B. And that's a very simple situation, and you can understand, because B would have bid mm-hmm. were it not for the fact that of the assurance it got from A, and so equity intervened to effectively deal with the unconscionable outcome when A had succeeded and decided not to share the spoils with B. Mm-hmm. That's simple. I think when you fast forward to the facts we're looking at today, it's a much more complicated joint venture mm-hmm. of a much higher value property. So it's really trying to apply that to the modern facts, I think, is where the courts find difficulty. Mm-hmm. In this case, Generator had argued that Lidl, as I say, held the property on constructive trust for the benefit of both. The court, the trial judge in the High Court, looked very closely at the facts, as I say, between the end of October and the beginning of February, where all of the crucial discussions took place. And I think really the key points to note are the subject to contract heading. All of the discussions between Generator and Lidl had been subject to contract, and that clearly meant that the both parties accepted that neither was legally bound to perform on them. And so both the High Court judge and the Court of Appeal resoundingly decided that in circumstances such as that, it wouldn't be equitable to hold Lidl to obligations which had only ever been discussed on a subject to contract basis. The fact that both parties were sophisticated commercial parties taking the benefit of, you know, high quality legal advice was also a significant factor in both the High Court and the Court of Appeal's decision. I think the court made it clear that in circumstances where you had parties without advice, or perhaps less sophisticated parties, it may be mm-hmm. it may be inclined to step in, but even then, I think, you know, the message that the case has sent out is that the courts are really only in the very most extreme of cases going to step in and effectively mm-hmm. right a bargain that was not completed between the parties.
So do you think the court has, in doing so, do you think it's reached a fair decision or a correct decision or both?
I think that's a difficult one. I see when you read the facts of the case and the discussions between the parties, and particularly as I highlighted earlier, that the bit that resonates with me is that, you know, Generator were critical to making good the opportunity for Lidl. But I think that's really as far as it goes, because ultimately, you know, it was a commercial naivety on the part of Generator that left them exposed to the situation. So, yeah, I do. I think it's easy to look at it and think, you know, perhaps the court should step in. But I think if you look at it the other way, it would, you know, if the court stepped in willy-nilly to situations where parties hadn't agreed contracts or legally binding obligations between themselves, it would ride a coach and horses between the sort of property transactional world as we know it.
It would, so what, looking at the wider implications of the case, what are the key lessons that you think should be learned from the decision in Generator?
I mean, that's a simple one and a difficult one in equal measure.
That's what we like to do.
I think the simple fact is if you are involved in a joint venture or any kind of collaborative attempt to extract some commercial benefit from a property transaction, then, you know, before that transaction begins, you ought to have very clear agreed terms with the other side, and you know, they ought to be recorded in legally binding documents. In circumstances where you don't, then you're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. But that ignores the commercial reality of situations where, you know, the world is moving fast, the market requires a quick reaction, an opportunity arises. Two parties, in this case, found the opportunity together. Quite often we see different situations where one party will introduce another to it. But, you know, the whole thing is moving quickly. In order to get the deal in the hands of the joint venture needs to move quickly, and quite often the agreements, you know, develop together. So the situation arises regularly, and I suppose placing sort of trust and good faith in your bedfellow is not necessarily you know, going to be supported by the courts.
Obviously, it comes with a risk. So, how best would you say developers that find themselves in similar situations to the one Generator was in this case can seek to protect themselves against the same kind of thing happening?
Well, I've probably partially answered that in the last answer, which is simply, you know, do the deal before, you know, enter, conclude your joint venture before either party steals or has the opportunity to steal a march on the other. But taking account of the second part of my answer to the last question, that's not always possible. So, you know, you could use lockout agreements or exclusivity agreements. And interestingly, in this case, there was a draft lockout agreement prepared between Generator and Lidl that was never entered into. But even that was unhelpful in its terms, because effectively it was an agreement that said they would explore together this possibility, but it made very clear on its terms that neither party was bound, as you would expect, because until such time as the parties have concluded terms acceptable to each, they wouldn't want to be bound to enter into a joint venture.
I imagine that Pallant, by its very nature, is fairly rarely applied, and usually its application is very sort of fact-sensitive.
Exactly. I mean, it's incredibly fact-sensitive, and I think really the outcome of the case we're talking about makes it even less likely to be applied in the future. The courts are saying that, you know, they will only really step in the most extreme of circumstances.
Many thanks for your time, James. And you have been listening to On the Case.
Thank you.